Welcome to This Is Money podcast, sponsored by Trading 212. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and Simon Lamb today is Sir Steve Webb, who is celebrating a very special anniversary. 10 years of being a columnist for This Is Money, replying to hundreds of readers with their pension problems, and in turn helping many thousands more with their own retirement savings. So we're going to do things a little differently today. In the first half of the show, we grill Steve on all things pensions, from the sustainability of the triple lock to whether those in their 30s and 40s slightly screwed, and what keeps them awake at night in the world of retirement savings. And in the second half, Simon and I will turn our focus elsewhere. How much can you really save on a new car? Is Barclays' offer to pay you a grand really such a good deal? And a decent problem to have, can you pass on an inheritance that you don't need? Don't forget to stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. But first, 10 years of being a columnist for This Is Money. And that's not his only job. He's also a partner at LCP as well, by the way. But he manages to fit it all in. So Steve, on behalf of all the readers who have definitely learnt a thing or two from you, thank you.
Thank you, Georgie. It's nice to be with you again.
Always a pleasure to have you on the show, Steve. Is there one letter I just want to ask? One letter. I know 10 years is a long time. My memory is not that good. But, or an issue that you've covered in that time that will stay with you forever?
Definitely. I mean, there are lots of individuals it's been possible to help, and you have to not lose sight of the individuals in all of this. But occasionally something snowballs and helps vast numbers of people. And I think back to a column in early 2020, an apparently innocent email from a gentleman who said his wife's state pension had seemed a bit low, and they phoned up and they got it increased, and he didn't think this was right the way it had worked. So we found out a bit. I learned something, I have to say, as I often do in replying to the column, and realized a bit more about how the system worked. We wrote that, and it started an avalanche. People writing in saying, well, hang on, mine's a bit low. And well, I'm a widow and mine is a bit low. And I'm over 80 and mine's a bit low. And roll forward 4 years and the government paid out £800 million in pensions arrears to over 100,000 people. And, you know, just from that one initial column.
Yeah, I can see why that would stay with you forever. has that all been sorted out now, Steve?
Well, yes and no. I mean, so there was a bonus win, which was that even the government looked at all of this and said, my goodness, how did this happen? We'd better do some proper checks. And so for the first time in years, they then did some extra checks and found another set of errors for women who've been at home bringing up children, not getting credits. They've already paid out another $100 million on that one. So in a sense, that's ongoing. We're still trying to get that sorted. But there are still aspects of this that are unresolved. I'm still supporting. In fact, the very first person who wrote in, that couple, have never got anything out of all of this.
Wow.
And I'm still supporting them. I've got a case with the Ombudsman at the moment. So it's ongoing, let's say.
Do us a favour, Steve. Sort of, does it all work for those of us who are not columnists or newspaper writers? How do you have a chat with Simon? Do you get loads of letters? Like, what's the process?
We get questions in every week emailed to pension questions at This Is Money. And Tanya Jeffries, my colleague on the team, sifts them all. She anonymizes them all. So I never know who it's from. So I'm always judging it on the issue. And then I have a look and I have happily total freedom. Occasionally, Tanya or Simon or Simon say, do you know what? I think this would, you know, this would attract a lot of interest. You know, if you're not sure what to do, this might be a good one. But no one's ever said you've got to do this or you can't do that. So that's, I really appreciate that. So I try and pick a topic, sometimes a general topic that I think will be of wide interest or that we haven't covered before, or something new. So like the government's changes to winter fuel payments, you know, has been all sorts of new rules. We're still trying to work out how it's all going to work. So yeah, I do things that are topical. And occasionally I'll just pick an individual. So a couple this week that I may write about in future weeks, you know, we've been battling for months to get them sorted. You know, gentleman over 80 living outside the UK, his company pension stopped, just couldn't get it started again. And today, you know, they've confirmed he's got the back payment, the money started again, his wife's written me a nice letter, and that kind of thing's rewarding as well. So we try and mix it up a bit, really.
Are there some big themes that keep coming up time and again?
Yeah, I think the most common theme underlying all of this is a surprisingly boring one, which is just pensions administration, just running these systems efficiently and well. And that was an error in the state pension. You know, calculations are not done. It happens in private pensions. I mean, it's a big row at the moment over civil service pensions, people who want to retire and can't get a retirement quote, or they phone up and they hang on the phone line for 2 hours and then they get cut off. just that sort of stuff drives people mad, and rightly so. And sometimes I think admin, it's not glamorous, so it doesn't get much attention. And people want, you know, governments and companies want to do it on the cheap. And when you do it on the cheap, people suffer.
Do you know, I sort of knew that was your answer, Steve, because I was reading the newsletter, the This Is Money newsletter, and it really struck me the way that you write it. So when we think about people getting a raw deal when it comes to pensions, it's tempting to think about crooks and scammers, you say. But after 10 years of responding to queries from readers of This Money, I've realised that something more mundane lies behind many of the problems that we have resolved. It's the simple matter of pensions administration. Crooks and scammers are a big deal, though. I mean, let's not diminish that. But yeah, something so simple can have such a devastating effect.
And that's right. And I think as pension schemes get bigger and bigger, so the government talks about mega funds. So in future, most of us who work in the private sector will be in one of probably half a dozen, maybe 10.
Like Australia.
It is. So they call them super funds in Australia, but same idea. And the risk is, if you're one of 7 million people in a pension scheme, how do you ever get anybody's attention? How do you get someone to notice? You know, how long are you on a call central dealing with an AI chatbot? You know, so we've got to, in the mass scale of pensions, not lose sight of the individual. That's the key.
Absolutely right. There have been so many changes, though, haven't there, Steve, to pensions over the last decade or so. I'm thinking auto-enrolment, the decline of the gold-plated pensions, triple lock, of course, and now pensions being included or will be included in the inheritance tax net. Very different landscape now. How do you assess it? I suppose some very good moves, some less so.
Yeah, I mean, the good stuff, it's easy to just kind of bank and move on. But I do think, I mean, I'm slightly biased, but the new state pension, although not everybody loves it, has done one big thing, which is it's treated men and women equally for the first time ever.
Just explain, what is the new compared to the old and why?
Yeah, so the old state pension, so for people who retired before 2016, were on that old system. And it was designed after the Second World War. Mm. And it was designed in a world where men went out to work, women looked after the home and the family. And in retirement, a woman was deemed not really to need a state pension because she had a husband. And so the whole system was designed around men getting the main or most of the pension. And then a woman got a bit more if her husband died, that kind of idea. But women were second class citizens, basically. And, you know, I was minister from 2010 to 2015. And we just looked at that system and said, look, how can we have something designed in the 1940s going into the 2010s? It just didn't make sense. So we restructure the whole thing. We didn't spend more money. We spent about the same, but said, let's try and remove this discrimination. And by about now, a man or a woman retiring today within a few pounds will get the same on average state pension. And the news is not perfect and controversies in it, but it means that women who often do badly on private pensions, at least the bit that the state does, excuse me, is a good thing. So, you know, I think that's positive. You mentioned automatic enrolment. That's another 10 million people at least starting on the pensions journey. So, yeah, positive stuff. But you're right. Constant change doesn't help. State pension ages going up have been difficult for people. Tax changes, speculation about more tax changes. So, you know, what we want is stability. And the government's just set up a pension commission to try and map out the 2030s. And that's the prize. If they can give us a long-term plan and stick to it, then we're in with a chance. But the annual tinkering just undermines confidence, I think.
And the tinkering doesn't stop, does it? Because there's a very big change coming up with pulling pensions into the inheritance tax net based off the suggestion that some wealthy people were using them, you know, to avoid inheritance tax, although it's quite a lot more nuanced than some of those claims make out. What do you make of that decision to pull pensions into inheritance tax? Are we not just penalising people who are doing exactly what they're meant to do in the private sector, which is start saving early and build up a pot that's going to be large enough to provide a comfortable retirement?
I can see why the government did it. I mean, apart from the fact that they're broke, there is an argument that says if I've saved in a stocks and shares ISA, for example, that was counted for inheritance tax. If I'd saved in exactly the same way, but it was just called a pension, it didn't count. And financial advisors, let's be frank, would say to people, take the money out of your ISA first, leave it in your pension because you'll pay less inheritance tax. So there were some people who were using it as an inheritance tax dodge, not as a savings vehicle. But I guess one of my big worries about this new system is the impact on the poor souls who have to deal with people's estates And for me, that's the worst aspect of all of this. It's that once someone's died, it's miserable enough as it is. You have to deal with what they call sadmin, you know, all the hassle, all the paperwork and so on. Now we're going to lump pensions in that. You've got to find the pensions. You've got to contact the companies. You've got to get information back. You've got to put it in a calculator. You've got to go back to the pension people. You've got to make sure the IHT is paid. And if you haven't done that in 6 months, there's a charge or a fine or a penalty. That's what really gets me about all of this. And I think, you know, that'll have to change it. It'll come in next year. It'll be awful for people. And there'll be a clamour to change it. But I wish they'd change it before rather than after.
Simon, what's your view on this?
I think it's the wrong move. And the reason why I think it's the wrong move is for a number of reasons. Firstly, what Steve just said about executors having to deal with this. It's going to be an absolute nightmare for people. Secondly, I think the government is making the mistake of putting two things together that are not the same. Most people's pensions are what they're going to need to rely on in retirement. And unless you are lucky enough to be in the public sector now, it's on you to build up your pension pot. And we underestimate how big a pension pot you need to have a comfortable or even a moderate retirement. The pension pot that you need for a comfortable retirement is basically £1 million. Now, that is the combined tax-free inheritance tax allowance for a couple. Now, most people will then use those pension pots to live on. Some wealthy people have been using them in order to dodge inheritance tax, but that's only beneficial to them if they die before the age of 75. Because if they die after the age of 75, it's taxed as income on the person who takes the money out of the pot. So whilst the inheritance tax isn't there at the moment, there is still tax there, the income tax element. And if you take any meaningful sum of money out of that pension pot as the beneficiary of it, you're going to end up paying higher rate tax because you're going to go into the 40% tax band. So a lot of that money that would be passed on for people who die after the age of 75, which most people die after the age of 75, right? So if you die before the age of 75, you're dying early. Most of that money will probably be taxed at 40% anyway. And then I also think it's one of those policies where it's painted as taxing one generation, but actually it's taxing another generation and penalizes another generation. So it's painted as a raid on wealthy boomers passing on money, right? Now, for a start, the wealthy boomers who are passing on the money, if they do this, by definition, they are dead, right? So you're not actually taxing them. You're taxing the people who benefit from the money. But, you know, that's the whole inheritance tax thing or whatever. But more to the point, that generation is far more likely to at least have some element of final salary or defined benefit pension scheme, right? It's the younger generations of private sector workers who are entirely dependent on defined contribution pots and are going to need to build up that big pot. And what we're creating is a system whereby if those people are unlucky enough to die early, whilst there's still a lot of money unspent in their pension pots, they will be penalized. And they will be penalized for having done what they were meant to do, which is save a big enough pension pot in order to fund their retirement. You know, and if they don't die early and they live until a very old age and they run down their pension pot, then that's great. They win because they live till a very old age, and they win because they get to spend their pension pot, and they win because they get to not pay inheritance tax. But it's penalizing the younger generation of savers. It's penalizing the people in their 20s, their 30s, their 40s, not the older generation who are already retired. And that's why I have a problem with it. And I think it's a real muddle. And I also think the other issue is that the government is willfully ignoring the fact that there is going to be an element of double taxation on those people who do die after the age of 75 and have unspent pension pots, because there's going to be inheritance tax on those pots. And then there's also going to be income tax charged on people taking the money out. And that's going to lead to, you know, near 70% tax rates on some of that money. And I just think that's wrong.
So a fair few bits to iron out. Just a shout out for those of us unmarried without children, 325,000, not a million. The problem, Steve, oftentimes people don't spend enough in retirement. They're so frightened of their pot running out, aren't they, that they sort of hold on to it. But we have the reverse problem that people are desperate not to give anything to the government. So they're like, right, I'm just going to spend all my money and then run out.
Well, I think we will see a big behavioural response to this measure. We're already seeing, you talk to financial advisors and people are queuing up to work out how to avoid the impact of the change that happens next April. And I suppose, again, another of my concerns about all of this is that there's a bit of a saying that inheritance tax is a tax paid by people who don't have advisors. Mm-hmm. You know, because on the whole, good planning for most people can get them out of it. What it tends to be the people right at the top who don't pay, and then the next people down who pay who didn't have advice. And that will happen with this as well. There are lots of things people can do. So people are looking at things like gifting out of surplus income. So you take your pension pot, you buy an annuity that you don't really need, that gives you spare money, you give that to the kids. And as long as it's spare money, it's immediately exempt from inheritance tax. You don't have to live 7 years. It's just a gift from spare income. So things like that people will do, they'll find ways around it. You know, there's lots of trusts being set up, offshore bonds, you know, the works really. So again, is it fair, a system where actually the very wealthiest will just find a way around it and it won't be those who pay the tax?
I want to ask you, we are having to make more choices with our money. As I said, the gold-plated pensions are, alas, for many, no more. These are big, big choices about where to invest our money, how to spend it, etc. And the reality is, whether we can afford it or not, most of us don't get financial advice. I think it's something like 9% have got financial advice. Are we anywhere close to being ready? And what needs to happen to make sure that we are ready to make such enormous decisions over our futures?
It's a big question. As you say, you know, if I think about my parents' generation, they knew the age at which they'd get a state pension because that hadn't changed. They knew, so my mum and dad both got small private sector DB pensions that lasted as long as they did. They had to make essentially no choice, and they both retired, I'm pretty sure, at state pension age. You know, it was all done for them. This generation, you know, I personally, I think we shouldn't expect people to have to do much of this for themselves. I think in building up a pot, what they call accumulation, you've got very clever people doing it for you. And as long as they're doing a good job, you shouldn't have to muck about with it. Fine if you want to. If you want to do something different, fine. But what they call defaults, the things that happen if you don't make a choice, we need those to be good and appropriate for people. So that helps people get a pretty decent pot. But then all the stuff about retirement, when you take it, do you take different pots? Do you combine them all in one place? People need a lot of help with that. I've got a controversial suggestion, Georgie, if I may.
Mm, yeah, go for it.
So if you think about mortgage advice, it's, I'm going to say, free. You can't see on the podcast the air quotes on free. It's kind of free. You know. So I've taken mortgage advice a couple of times and I've perceived it as free. Somebody's paying the advisor's wages. I know that. It's somewhere in the system. I'm probably paying somewhere. But to me, it was free. So I freely, gladly took mortgage advice, got some good advice and got on with my life. Pensions, that's banned. You can't have free pensions advice because they banned it 15 years ago because they were worried advisors were steering people towards whatever gave them the biggest commission. I wonder if we could bring back free pension advice where we're transparent that the advisor's paid by somebody, paid by the pensions industry, but somehow, you know, we can see what they're doing. We can see if they've steered us towards the thing they get the most commission from, whatever. But we've basically killed financial advice for the mass market. And so many people could really do with it. Now, AI and nudges and all that stuff will get us some of the way. But I wonder if we could bring back free pensions advice.
Is there not some sort of pension advisory service already where we can get some sort of free information?
Information, yes. Guidance, yes. Mm-hmm. Advice, no. So there's a thing called PensionWise, which the government set up after the pension freedoms came in. So it was like, I'm over 55, I can touch my pot, but you know, what's drawdown? What's flexi access drawdown? What's an annuity? All that stuff. So you can phone them up. They're not going to try and sell you anything. It's impartial. Great. But at the end of the call, you say to them, so what do you think I should do? And they say, sorry, you know, not my job. Mm-hmm. That's the problem. You know, you can explain the rules, but how people judge, you know, in their unique individual circumstances, what's right for them. That's what's missing.
What do you reckon of that idea, Simon? Free pension advice?
I think it's a very interesting subject and a thorny issue. And there is definitely a scenario, as Steve outlines, that way less people are getting any form of financial advice now due to the way that the payments system is structured. It creates a more honest system. Advisors aren't getting rewarded for selling products in the way that they used to. And there's been an awful lot of mis-selling in the financial advice industry over the years. But it does also create a situation where people are being asked to pay thousands of pounds up front for something. They're like, well, I don't have the money. Now, what you should be thinking about in that instance is probably the value of that advice is going to massively outweigh the cost over your retirement, and you know you should do it. But that's the theory of what you should be doing. In practice, what's actually happening is people aren't doing it. So I do think that there is a scenario where something has to change. Steve, we touched on the kind of the younger generations, the people saving for their pensions. Now, if you look at the retirement living standards put out by Pensions UK that benchmark the figures of how much you need, for a moderate retirement at the moment, they say a couple would need £43,900, right? And obviously, that's for a couple retiring now. If you're in your 30s and you're not retiring for another 30 years, you need to factor in what inflation is going to do to that. And I did the maths while you and Georgie were just speaking. Even if inflation is only 2%, which is the Bank of England's target, and that's a big if there, isn't it? Especially in light of recent things that have gone on. That sum in 30 years' time is going to be £79,950. So that's basically 80 grand. So a couple would need an income of 80 grand a year. You're going to need a really big pension pot between you to do that. Are people in their 30s and 40s going to have enough money for retirement, in your view?
Short answer is lots of them aren't, unless we do something. I mean, it's probably worse for single people, because the benchmarks for single people are even scarier, funnily enough, relative to, you know, the state pension is a smaller percentage of the figures for single people. But I guess that's why this pension commission is so important, because the first pensions commission laid the groundwork for automatic enrolment for 10 million people starting on the pension savings journey, which was great. But then it stopped. And essentially, we got to 8% contributions in 2018-ish, 2018-19. We'll have wasted a decade. You know, nothing's going to happen in this parliament. We know that already. So we've lost a decade. Whereas in Australia, they've been going from 3% to 6 to 9 to 12. It's taken them 30 years to do it, but they've got to 12 now. We're still kind of dithering around. So to answer your question, unless the mandatory minimum contributions go up gradually but significantly, an awful lot of people will have some pretty unpalatable choices. And basically, it's go on working past the point where you want to or retire poor. There isn't really a third option.
Oh, sobering, Steve. Let's talk on a lighter note. Let's talk about the state pension, the triple lock. Easy time, Steve. And I feel like every time we have you on the show, I ask you the same old thing. So sorry, but you know, it is a really important question. And I think it's going. You said earlier the government's broke. Like, is it time we really had some tough conversations about how sustainable it is?
Yeah, I think all political parties would now like to stop it. So as I often say, when we started it in around 2010, 2011, it was trying to undo 30 years of damage to the state pension. So for the previous 30 years, the state pension had been eroded year after year after year. It was falling relative to the average wage. So the triple lock was a mechanism to right a wrong, in my view, and it's been running for 15 years. So 15 years to fix a 30-year hurt, maybe that's not unreasonable. But once we got the state pension to a decent sort of level, maybe a third of the average wage, and we're not far short of that now, maybe you then lock it. So you say, right, we've used the triple lock. It's done its job. We've got to a third of the average wage. The pension will now always be a third of the average wage. So that's a kind of earnings link. I think that's probably where we need to get to. It's just everyone's waiting for somebody else to ditch it. And that's how it's managed to survive this long, I think.
I mean, you said every politician probably... where every political party would want to get rid of it. But Steve, we forget, because you're such a nice guy, that you were once a politician too. So you know about the machinations behind the scenes. There's going to be a really tough call. Politically
speaking. It is. Yeah, and the government has to make it first, because everyone can wait for the government. So the government will be thinking, how do we get ourselves off the hook on this? And one way of doing it would be to say, look, the Labour manifesto said triple lock for the rest of this parliament, so we're going to honour that. And actually, we're going to run it on for a few more years until we hit this third of the average wage or whatever benchmark, and then we'll lock it. So I, the Chancellor, not only have I kept my promise on the triple lock, I'm actually going to extend it for a few more years and then lock in that good state pension. They'll still have national newspaper headlines slagging them off for scrapping the triple lock, but that's probably the least worst way of switching it off, I think.
Simon, as a publisher of a major financial newspaper section, what headline would you write?
Well, obviously, any government that removes the triple lock is going to end up being criticised, and it's going to end up upsetting a lot of pensioners, because there's a lot of pensioners out there and there's a lot of people about to claim their state pension. Demographically, they wield a lot of power. But I think what everybody recognises and what we're increasingly starting to see highlighted is that young people are getting a pretty raw deal and have had a pretty raw deal over the last 10 years, 20 years. Youth unemployment is a major issue now. Young people are going into an uncertain jobs market. There's a big concern over student debt, for example. You know, the cost of living, all those kinds of things, first-time buyers, rental levels and stuff. So is it fair that they are funding a generous policy for the older generation that has more money? Now, that's not to say that everybody in the older generation has more money. And the great thing about being a young person who's working is, you know what, you could just go out and do some more work to earn some more money. And that's not an option that lots of 75-year-olds, for example, have. But I do think, as Steve said, that it is time to call time on this, and politicians need to be brave enough to do it. And the one thing that's really interesting that popped up this week is that the one political party that has sort of slightly stuck its head above the parapet on this is Reform. Now, I'm no great fan of Reform and Nigel Farage, as many listeners will know, and I get criticised for that by some of our listeners in the comments on the podcast. We do read them. I do see them. So, you know, but it is not a political podcast, okay? I'm an equal opportunities criticiser of political parties.
Criticise everybody.
They're all a bunch of mugs as far as I'm concerned. And I'd really like to see somebody come in and do a better job, okay? And I don't care which party they're from. But Nigel Farage has said that the triple lock is up for debate, open for debate, he said. After Robert Jenrick had supported it, but Nigel Farage said it's open for debate. Now, Reform, they could blow this wide open if they come out and say, do you know what? Unfortunately, we can't afford it anymore, and we're going to have to stop it. Because then all of a sudden you've opened up the debate and it becomes acceptable for the Labour Party or the Tories or the Lib Dems to go, yeah, do you know what? Actually, we probably do need to have a proper conversation about this, and we might need to stop this. So who knows? Maybe.
Knows indeed. Well, I mean, from the triple lock to Steve, and whenever I talk to young people about the state pension, they just go, "Prr, it won't exist when I'm older, will it? Or will it be means tested or some such thing?"
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm quite optimistic about this. I mean, I can see why people would say it. So, for example, in Australia, the state pension is already means tested. If you've got a big superannuation pot pension, you don't get a state pension at all. So it could happen. In the UK, we've seen winter fuel payments taken away from better off pensioners. So again, there's a precedent there. But there's a world of difference between taking away a winter fuel payment of up to £300 a year and taking away a state pension of 12,500. I mean, it's just, you know. And for me, the biggest reason I think it won't happen, means testing, is how do you get from here to there? What would have to happen? So a minister has to stand up, maybe put it in a manifesto, although they'd be terrified to say, vote for us and we'll means test the state pension. They might just do
exactly.
It.
Exactly. Great.
Might just do it after an election. But minister stands up and says, okay, we want to save some money, so the state pension won't be paid to people with income above such and such. So do they do it immediately? Well, they can't, can they? Can't say to people, as Simon just said, you've already retired, you can't really go back to work, we're taking it away from you. So, right, everybody currently on the state pension probably protected. What about people a year away, 2 years away, 3 years away, who, frankly, may have retired, got all their plans worked out, drawing a company pension, whatever? Can you take it away from them? Probably not. But as soon as you say, well, we'll do this in 5 years' time, say minimum of 5 years, that's a parliament. That's a whole parliament. So you get no savings in the before the next election, no money to spend on the NHS or tax cuts or anything, and all the political grief. And politicians don't like no money and all the grief. They want all the money and none of the grief. So yeah. I just don't see how you get from here to there, personally.
Not exclusive to politicians either.
Well, no.
I think there's also another issue as well, which is that how do you define the means testing? What do you do to do the means testing? Steve said that, you know, people with an income above a certain level. That is by far and away the most obvious way to do the means testing. However, there is a crucial point in which we have created a retirement system, a pension system, where people's income in retirement is increasingly flexible. They can decide how much money they take out of their pension. And if you needed to have an income below X in order to get your state pension, well, you just take less money out of your pension in retirement. You just draw less money from it and you would keep your income below that level. The only people who couldn't do that would be people with defined benefit pensions, most of whom will in the future be public sector workers. And can you see a government going to war with all of the public sector workers on pensions? I mean, maybe the Tories or Reform might, but the Labour Party certainly aren't going to.
Yep, quite. Just before we move on, Steve, you mentioned there about gender a little bit earlier. The WASPI campaign, I feel like that's been going on and it's not quite over yet, even still now. Was it a fair decision?
I would have liked the government to have accepted what the ombudsman said. So, I mean, there's thousands of hours of history towards this, but basically what the parliamentary ombudsman said is, look, governments can decide what the pension age is. Parliament can just decide that. That's not what this is about. It's about having realised that women, some women, didn't know about the changes. Did they act efficiently, effectively? And what the ombudsman said is, do you know what? They didn't. They knew years ahead that lots of women didn't know. They should have taken effective action. They didn't. You can't come up with an individual compensation scheme for 10 million women. So here's a sort of token flat rate amount per woman. And that's what the ombudsman recommended. And I just think if you have a parliamentary ombudsman who scrutinises government, is independent, set up by parliament, that's why it's called the parliamentary ombudsman. Parliament set it up to scrutinise government. And if they independently recommend compensation, then I think it should be paid. Now, maybe not the full whack, because like Equitable Life, they recommended 5 billion of compensation. In the end, 1.5 billion was paid because that's what the government felt they could afford. So maybe not the huge bill that it might cost. But I think the principle of an independent ombudsman making recommendations, once we say government departments can just ignore it, we risk destroying that. And that, for me, is the most important thing.
All right then, Steve, what keeps you awake at night when you think about pensions and retirement?
I'm trying to work out when I'm going to retire, but maybe a few more columns yet before I do.
Yeah, that's what we want to hear, Steve. You're not allowed to retire.
Yeah. I mean, it is funny enough, it's that thing we've already talked about, which is that whole group of people who are simply not saving enough and maybe don't even realise they're not saving enough. You know, a whole generation who, you know, they didn't get the gold-plated pensions of yesteryear. They're not building up enough to replace them. We're wasting time. You know, I said we've wasted a decade and we really have. And unless we get a move on, you know, that whole, you know, the state pension will get people to the starting gate, but people want more than that. And we're letting them down if we don't get a move on. So that's my biggest concern, really.
Obviously, because we can't end on a negative there, Steve. If you could give a pep talk to someone worried about their financial future now, what would you say? Like some tips, some advice to how to, you know, get yourself on a good path to retirement, because it's always a lot of gloom and doom. And if you open up the pages of the newspaper or online, it's a bit like we are all stuffed, aren't we? So a bit of positivity from you, Steve.
Yeah, I think the way to take control is to know where you stand. You know, you can't make a plan if you don't know where you're starting from. So, you know, get a state pension forecast, work out what you're going to get. Get together all those pension letters you've never opened and please don't bin them. I mean, if you don't open them, stick them in a pile on the corner and occasionally have a look at them. Find out what you're going to get. You know, next year, I think the pensions dashboard will go live. People will see in one place all their pensions and that will help. And then you'll be able to see what you've got, what you can expect and have a look at that. And if that's not what you want, then, you know, often at work, there'll be a pension department or you can get an advisor through work or, you know, if you work for a bigger company and start thinking what you could do. Often your company will do more if you do, you know, making the most of what you've got, all that kind of stuff. You know, I mean, you know, look at This Is Money every week and make the most of the money you've got. You know, there are things you can do to take control. But if you bury your head in the sand, if you think, oh, it's all too terrifying, I'm not going to look till I'm 60, it's kind of left it a bit late, really. So, you know, find out where you stand.
Nice tip there. Before I let you go, Steve, Simon, final word, 10 years, blow some well-deserved wind.
Well, I mean, the first thing I would say is that over the last 10 years, Steve has been working tirelessly to write his columns for us. And the amount of work that goes on behind the scenes to do that is immense. And he deserves a huge amount of credit for that. Right, because he's genuinely doing something that is really, really helping people out and putting a lot of work into it and also delivering great stories. You know, people love these Steve's columns. They love to read them. Our readers absolutely love the columns. Every Monday, people come in to read Steve's columns. And that's great. It's a column about pensions and retirement. And we've got it's a point of view, you know, that's absolutely brilliant. But also, it's sort of the level of financial education over that period of time, because as humans, we learn through stories. That's the way that we learn through, you know, centuries, millennia, however long we've, I don't know how long we've been around, long time, right? You know, and people reading those columns are learning something, and the amount of financial education that's gone on over those 10 years through Steve's columns is absolutely immense. And so I take my hat off to him for doing them. And I'm also very, very grateful because lots of people love reading them.
Yeah. Obviously, it wouldn't be so long. So, Steve, here's to the next 10 years. I hope you'll be back on the show.
You know what we said about retiring. That's very kind, Simon. And yeah, I appreciate the opportunity. It's very rewarding. I appreciate all the work that your colleague Tanya Jeffries does as well, because she's a key part of the whole process.
Been a pleasure. Nice to see you both. Thank you.
Right, let's crack on. A screeching handbrake turn there from pensions to cars now, Simon. Let's be honest, few of us really enjoy haggling, let alone with a car salesman. But what if you knew exactly how much they're willing to come down on the price of a new car before even stepping foot into the showroom? Well, this is money can help. Firstly, before we get into the details of this one, Simon, it wouldn't cross my mind to haggle on a new car.
Would it not?
Is this a normal thing? No, do you? I mean, I've never bought a new car, so...
Oh, you absolutely must haggle on a car. Cars are like a classic
secondhand
haggling.
Yeah.
No. I mean, you've got what's known as the list price, right? Which is what the manufacturer says the car will sell at. But then more complicatedly, you've got the on the road price, which is the cost of getting that car on the road, right? So that's the one that you treat it as, because that includes like the tax and stuff like that for the first year and things. But these prices are entirely negotiable. And there's a number of layers of an onion going on here where you can get some money off and, you know, different elements where you can go, okay, here, there. So don't pay this price.
Okay, so my fault there. But like I said, I've never bought a new car, so it doesn't strike me. But even with a secondhand car, even with anything, the idea of haggling is just a bit, ooh. So how much money can you genuinely save? I mean, obviously it depends where you're haggling, but is there sort of like a ballpark figure you can get?
Well, I mean, let's look at Britain's top-selling car, okay? The Ford Puma. You could get a 10% discount on this. So the average retail price is $30,878. The achievable price, according to our experts at Insider Car Deals, is £27,305. So that's a £3,573 saving. Kia Sportage, 11.7% discount. Nissan Qashqai, you could get 19% off a Qashqai. So many Qashqais are sold, but you could pay nearly 20% less than the list price on one of these. And then, you know, lots of other cars that we feature in the article. A Golf, VW Golf. Who doesn't love a Golf? Jeremy Clarkson basically says the answer is buy a Golf. Pretty much, whatever question there is about what car you should get, the answer is
buy a Golf.
Just buy a Golf, right? Yeah. 19.3% discount you could get off that. Average retail price, $35,492. According to Insider Car Deals, £27,410. You could save £8,800, right? And we've got a discounted example here of a 1.5 TSI 150R line. Obviously, you know exactly what that is, Georgie.
Oh, yeah. I've got one.
A 23.8% discount on that car.
It's not rubbish cars, is it?
No. It's good cars.
These are cars people actually want to buy. So how can you get the discounts then on cars?
Right. So
not rubbish.
But where has this information come from? Okay, this has come from Pat Hoy, okay, who is the founder of a website called Insider Car Deals. Now, Pat Hoy has got decades, in fact, of experience working in the motor trade. He has got access to information from manufacturers, showroom networks on the current prices and what they can get them down to. Plus, and this is a really important bit, Pat has a team of mystery shoppers who are out there testing this stuff out and seeing what they can get off cars up and down the country every day. Okay. Pat then takes all that information, synthesizes it, and pulls together details on the best prices that you could get on a new car. And if you are going to go out and buy a new car, and bear in mind the figures that we've talked about here, we're talking about the price of the car, right? The actual, you know, price tag on this is what this car would cost you. Most people don't buy cars like that anymore. They buy them on PCP finance deals, right? And actually, you can get a better deal by taking the finance than you can by buying the car outright, which often surprises a lot of people. Lots of people think if they go into the dealership and say, I could pay you cash, dealer will be like, right, well, I'm going to give you my special discount.
That's not the case.
They want you to take out the finance agreement. If you take out the finance agreement, they can probably offer you a better price. So what quite a few savvy people who don't want the finance agreement will do is they go in, they buy the car on the finance agreement, and then they pay off the finance agreement early on. So I think you've got about 3 months and then you can pay off the finance agreement. So go in, take out the finance, buy the car, get the best price they possibly can, and then 3 months' time, pay off the finance, no penalties or anything like that, and then they own the car outright. Most people, though, just keep paying the finance deal. But if you are going to buy a new car, right, then I would strongly recommend that you go to Pat's website, Insider Car Deals, where he offers a number of services, right? And you will have to pay for some of these services, okay? And no, we don't like paying for things nowadays on the internet where we think everything should be free. But you will have to pay. But what you will get is a personal deal sheet based on the car that you want to buy that will explain to you the exact discount that you could probably get and what you should be targeting and how to do it. And the discount that you're going to get on that car is going to massively outweigh the price that you pay for that service, you know, from Pat's website. So if you were going to buy a new car, then I would say do this. It makes perfect sense. But anyway, Pat's given us this information for a story that we've done this week, and we're running a series of stories based on the stuff that, you know, that Pat's told us. And it's absolutely fascinating, you know, how you can do this even on some of the best-selling cars. But you have to keep going. That's the other thing. Don't, when you go in there, go, well, what's the best price you can offer me? And then the salesman or saleswoman goes, well, it's X. It's the absolute best I can do. And you're robbing my children of shoes here. Don't listen to that. Don't listen to that nonsense. They are giving you the best. They are giving you the best deal. You need to push them. You need to go back and push them. And it's when they think that you're really going to buy the car, right? Then when they're like, okay, this person might actually buy the car, but you say to them, I would, but like, it's above my budget and I'm looking at some other cars, and you know, it's when they think they can reel you in that they'll then give you the best price.
But
you don't accept the first one they offer. Keep going back to them. Do that and you will get the best price.
Right. Now, for the latest nice problem to have reader question time, I've recently received just under £20,000 from my late mother's will. That's not the nice problem, by the way. Obviously, it's sad that you get an inheritance always, but just to say, they don't need it because they pass some to their children and grandchildren, already using the annual £3,000 inheritance tax allowance to do this. But they would like to give them more. As they don't need the money to live on, can I treat this as a gift from surplus income? If that is the case, do I have to give all the money bequeathed to me in order to comply with the, quote, pattern of giving I have established, where I gift all of my surplus income each year? Right, there's a lot in this, Simon. Firstly, the small gifts is involved here. The gift from surplus income, tie it all together, and what do we have? So, the small gifts allowance.
Yes, right. So, every year, you can give away up to £3,000 as an individual, free of inheritance tax. And any money that you give above that becomes potentially liable for
one person,
tax.
Or so is it £3,000? You can divvy that up between two people, or you have to just give it to one person alone?
Oh yeah, you can divvy that up.
If they're getting married, you can also give them some money too.
Yeah, right. So if they're getting married, you can give them £5,000. There's a special allowance for that. Mm-hmm. And you can give people individual gifts of up to £250 to as many recipients as you want. Mm-hmm. See our previous question from someone who asked whether he could give £100,000 away in £250 chunks, to which the answer is no. But look, these gift limits are massively outdated. They haven't been they haven't been raised since the 1980s. And something that people will notice is that life has got more expensive since the 1980s. This thing called inflation has happened. And this illustrates why inheritance tax just needs a complete overhaul. But the governments have just been sticking their head in the sand and turning it into a cash cow for years. And it's a hideous tax. It's hated by most people. It's the most hated tax. Hardly anybody pays it. If you've got the most hated tax, but hardly anybody pays it, other than like rich people, you just need to take a long, hard look at it because it's counterproductive. But anyway, the point is, these are the rules, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Give away up to £3,000 per year. You can give away more than that, but then it becomes potentially liable for inheritance tax unless you live for another 7 years. Now, there is a loophole, which is you can give away money out of surplus income. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't fall within this seven-year rule, and it doesn't fall within the normal allowances. But this has to be surplus income, so income that you don't need to maintain your standard of living. And it also has to be income, right? And this is important for the answer to this question. And there also has to be a pattern of regular giving. Now, the pattern of regular giving is a really grey and nebulous area. Right. So it could be you gave one gift per year, or it could be you gave one gift per month, or it could be every 3 months, could be every 6 months.
Mm.
There needs to be a pattern. So you need to establish that pattern. And what you need to do is you need to establish that pattern, and then you need to write it down and say what you're doing, because at some point, potentially, your executor is going to need that information. And the reason why they're going to need that information is because you will be dead. And therefore, they will not be able to ask you the question of what you were doing because you are dead. Mm-hmm. And this creates a major issue, as Steve was talking about in the first half of the show, for executors. So, you know, if you're going to do something like this, or you have a family member who's doing something like this, do everyone a favor. Write it down. Write a letter. You don't have to send the letter to anyone, but just write something down that says, this is what I'm doing. Here's where you can see what I'm doing. And a crucial bit for this question is this isn't income. This is capital. This is not income. If someone leaves you money, it's not income. It's capital. If you take money out of your ISA, it's not income. It's capital. If you withdraw money regularly out of your pension, however, that is considered income, right? But you can't just take it out of your savings, can't take it out of your house, can't take it from inheritance, and so on. So in this instance, unfortunately, this is not a way to get around it. There is, however, something that you can do if you are left money as an inheritance in someone's will and you don't need the money and you would rather pass it on to the younger generation. And this is something that not a lot of people know about, but this is an issue that does affect lots of people because inheritances actually tend to come to people when they are much older than we think. People are, I think the average age of inheriting is in the 60s, by which point, most people are in the financial position where they don't really need that money, but their children, on the other hand, are in a situation where they might be needing house deposits, you know, money to help pay for their kids and their lives and all those other things that are very expensive. And you can do something called a deed of variation, which means you can redirect all or part of an inheritance to somebody else. This is a legal document. You need to speak to a solicitor about this, but it is relatively simple to do. And by doing this, the gift is treated as if it came from the person's estate rather than from yourself and then goes to the other person. So the classic example of this is exactly this kind of thing, right? Grandparent dies, leaves their money to their own child. Their own child, who is a parent of adult children themselves, goes, well, do you know what? I don't need this money. And in fact, I'm going to have an inheritance tax liability myself.
Yeah.
So it's better if this money went to my children, my adult children instead. You can do a deed of variation, which effectively means that the money didn't come to you and it goes to them. Now, what's interesting is it can be executed within 2 years of death and with agreement from all affected beneficiaries. So it doesn't have to be immediate. So if you are in this situation or your family's in this situation, then speak to a solicitor.
I'm just thinking with this particular case, you said it doesn't have to be immediate, but it seems like they've already received the money. So I assume if that's the case, that ship has sailed for this particular person. But if you haven't taken possession of the money, is that sort of what I'm hearing?
Well, in the answer that we have from Andrew Smith, who's an independent financial advisor at Flying Colours, he has highlighted this potential use of the deed of variation being another sort of alternative solution in answer to this question. So it does sound as if, even if it appears the ship has sailed, that it may not have sailed if it set sail less than 2 years ago.
Got it. All right. Just get some proper advice on that one then. All right, finally, Barclays will pay you up to a massive £1,000 to open a Premier account and switch your cash ISA. Simon, that is a lot of money, isn't it? Too good to be true.
It is a lot of money, isn't it?
Mm.
It's a lot of money. I mean, these cashback deals are coming thick and fast at the moment, and a lot of them come from banks off trying to get you to join, right, on one hand, and on the other hand, investment platforms trying to get you to sign up. The Barclays one here is trying to get people to open Barclays' Premier account, right? And you have to do that through the current account switching service. And you can get a £400 cash sweetener if you do that. There's a catch. You must pay a pre-tax annual income of £75,000 into the account, or have at least £100,000 in savings or investments with Barclays, or a mix of both, in order to be eligible for Barclays Premier account. Now, in return for that, you'll get free Apple TV Plus. Don't know what the difference is between Apple TV and Apple TV Plus, but you're getting the one that says TV Plus on it.
Super.
Cash back on spending and enhanced rates on your savings. And you don't pay a monthly fee for this Premier account. This is one of those Premier accounts that you don't pay a monthly fee for. But you can't hold a current account with Barclays as of the 17th of February 2026. And you need to open your Barclays Premier account in the Barclays app. And the offer ends on the 30th of April. Now, you then have to complete a full switch in the app, including at least two active direct debits. And you must pay at least £4,000 into the new Premier current account within 30 days of opening it. If you clear all of these hoops, you will get £400. So how do you get the other £600? I hear you ask. What you need to do there is move a cash ISA pot that is worth £100,000 or more,
right,
and have a Barclays Premier Bank account. So it's quite a big hurdle here.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you lost me at the other 100,000.
Yeah. Right. So anyway, if you've got a lot of money, you can get a lot of money, right?
In that now, true in life, yeah.
If you have a Premier account, and it has to be a fixed rate ISA, it's not just their standard ISA. If you have a Premier account, then Barclays rates, you get a slightly better rate. So it's 1 year fixed rate, flexible ISA, offers a rate of 3.8%. If you've got a Premier account, it will pay you 3.85%. Now, that's not the best on the market for a one-year fixed rate ISA. But if you get £600 cash back on moving £100,000, that's the equivalent of a 0.6% boost on your rate over the year, which takes your 3.85% up above the best one-year fixed rate ISAs on the market. So you're actually winning. However, if you don't have a Premier account, you only get £200 for transferring in your ISA, which is only a 0.2% boost. You get a lower rate on your cash ISA, and you don't beat the best rate on the open market. And also, as I said, these are only fixed rate ISAs. So what you could do instead, if you just want an easy access ISA, is just choose one of the best easy access ISAs. And the best one on the market, in my view, is the one that has the least hoops to jump through to get it. It's totally flexible. You can take your money out when you want to. It's a proper cash ISA, and it comes from Trading 212, and it pays 4.4% on an easy access cash ISA, which is a great deal. Actually, I should say that if you want to look up the best cash ISA rates, then you need to go to thisismoney.co.uk/save, where you will find our savings tables, and we highlight all of the best deals.
And just to say, Simon, Apple TV apparently is a physical hardware device, while Apple TV Plus is the service, similar to Netflix. So don't get them confused. Right, Simon, stat of the week.
7.3%. That is how much the FTSE 100 is up this year already.
7.3%.
That is seriously impressive performance for the UK stock market. That is, you would be happy with a 7.3% return in most years. That's a good investment return. And it's only the 20th of February. Obviously, there are many months.
You is yet left, young.
And anything could possibly happen. But often a good start to the year indicates a good year for investors. But what is going on here is that the UK stock market is suddenly looking a lot more attractive to investors around the world. Some of that money is starting to shift from big US tech into other markets, and the UK stock market, people are sitting up and paying attention to it. And we've been waiting for this to happen for a really, really, really long time. It started to happen last year, and it looks like the effect is continuing this year. So, good news.
Thank you very much, Simon. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you would like them to look into, Simon.
You can email us, podcast@thisismoney.co.uk. Send us your questions. If you've got a question, send us a question. We will answer it on the podcast. You can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to find all podcasts past and join in the debate and read the comments. Come and tell us about what you think on the things that we've been talking about this week.
And if you have any questions for Steve as well, he mentioned the email address right at the top of the show. If anyone's forgotten it, it is
pensionquestions@thisismoney.co.uk.
Does what it says on the tin. And if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.